for the afternoon. A high of 73 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. This morning, wind from the north-northeast at 8. Still a good cloud cover, 59 degrees in Racine, 62 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from UW Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with a new master's in mental health and counseling from Parkside. Visit uwp.edu. Support also comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going back in the archives to an interview recorded back in 2004 with historian John Meacham about his book Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship. I am replaying this conversation today because Carthage College is very excited to be welcoming John Meacham to its campus on commencement weekend. That is the weekend before Memorial Day, for a special public event Saturday afternoon. It's an opportunity to meet this best-selling author and highly regarded historian. In honor of his upcoming visit, here is this previous interview from the archives.
And I am so grateful that John Meacham has written the book Franklin and Winston, which takes a look at two of the most fascinating and pivotal figures in the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, but does so through a rather unique perspective, examining their relationship and friendship, and charts the course of that friendship through, of course, very, very turbulent, world-altering years. And it is a perspective which I have never seen explored in such remarkable depth and detail as in this wonderful new book. John Meacham is a busy man. He is managing editor of Newsweek magazine, as a matter of fact. And so I'm especially grateful that we have a few minutes of his time to talk about this marvelous book. John Meacham, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
If I may ask for just 30 seconds about something aside from the book, we happen to be talking right in the midst of the capture of Saddam Hussein. What happens at a place like Newsweek in the wake of an event like that?
Well, we move fast. We got the call. I got the call about 5:30 in the morning on Sunday. You know, we go to press at 6 a.m. on Sunday. We've closed the magazine overnight Saturday. And the phone rang at home, and we were all back in here by 6:45 or so. We'd stopped the presses. We basically pulped, as we say, the million magazines we had already printed and started anew. And basically in about 5 hours, we put out a 16-page cover package and a new cover and made all our newsstands and all our subscribers in about a four-hour drill. The last time we had to do something like that at that scope was when Diana died, which was on the same kind of weekend schedule. So I never thought we would be able to say stop the presses once in life, much less twice.
And so such a thing is possible, literally and figuratively, to stop the presses.
We stopped the presses. And I must say, for a consequential and important story like this, it's one of the reasons we go into the business you and I are in.
Absolutely. I am so grateful for you writing this wonderful new book. May I ask first a fairly simple, basic question, but I am so curious to know how you got the idea of approaching FDR and Winston Churchill from this particular perspective.
Sure. I've always thought it was the most fascinating friendship of modern times, but I had not really focused on the amount of time they spent together and the scope of the relationship until 5 years ago. In the autumn of 1998, I was to deliver a eulogy for a dear friend who was the late editor of Newsweek, and I was just leafing around looking at great tributes. And I remembered years ago reading Churchill's For Roosevelt in April of 1945. And so I went back and looked at that and was struck. You know, Churchill never got over being a journalist. He was a war reporter as a young man and made his living by his pen. And many of the great war speeches, including this one, have a lot of facts and figures in them. He was a reporter. We remember the stirring rhetoric, but he also very much believed that he needed to arm the people with facts. And he counted it up. He said 120 days. It was actually 113. But I think we can give him a week, given that he defeated Hitler. Nearly 2,000 letters. They spent Thanksgiving together. They spent Christmas together. They spent New Year's together. They would do things like discuss the atomic bomb while they were fishing at Camp David. They met often secretly at Casablanca, at Tehran, at Yalta, several times in the United States. 62 years ago this month, Churchill spent Christmas at the White House, a detail that Franklin Roosevelt did not mention to his wife until the morning before Churchill arrived. I'm not sure the rest of us would have survived that marital moment, but Franklin Roosevelt did. And what I really wanted to do is give readers a sense of what they sounded like, what they were like together. I wanted people to smell the cigar and cigarette smoke and taste those awful martinis that Roosevelt used to make, 3/4 vermouth to 1 part gin, which is, it's amazing we won the Second World War if that's what he was drinking. but I really think that we needed a book about how leaders are real people. Politicians don't check their emotions at the door of a summit meeting. History is, of course, influenced heavily by large impersonal forces, but it's also decided by people rather like you and me in moments when they are sometimes subject to the forces of jealousy or affection or anger. And I wanted to explore that through two of the most human leaders of the 20th century and also two of the greatest. Because you can see there, you see both sides of it. These guys could be petulant, they could be difficult, they could be cold, they could be out of sorts, God knows they could be sick. They worried about their wives, they worried about their children, they worried about their health, they worried about each other's health, they worried about reporters, they worried about the opposition. And I think sometimes history recedes a little too rapidly into monumentalism. I think Roosevelt and Churchill, for many, many people, are black and white pictures now and maybe a scratchy voice on a newsreel. But in fact, they were flesh and blood, and more fascinating and more important to us for that. You know,
as human beings.
Yeah, I think so.
Not just as world leaders.
Right, and I think they teach us more if we realize that they weren't always on Mount Rushmore. That the idea that Churchill and Roosevelt, and this is one of the parallels with Bush and Blair today, Churchill and Roosevelt were reviled by large segments of their population. They had a very hostile press to deal with. They had large portions of public opinion, either mass or elite, against them. And yet they chose to fight battles beyond their borders, projecting power in a unilateral way, if that sounds familiar, in order to achieve goals they thought were important. And if they had to get out a little further ahead of their followers than they would have liked, that was the essence of their political courage. Mm.
One of the things, of course, that makes this a fascinating friendship to examine, beyond the fact that it's the friendship between two pivotally important world leaders, is the fact that they were also, although they certainly shared certain characteristics, these were two individuals with some striking differences between them. Tell us about a couple of them which you think are the most striking and significant.
I think the most important difference it's how they were raised. For all the outward trappings, Churchill was the son of the Chancellor of the Exchequer and a descendant of the great Duke of Marlborough. Franklin Roosevelt was the cousin of the great President Theodore Roosevelt. They both came from the highest levels of the aristocracy of their given countries. For all of that, they were raised by two very different American women. Jenny Jerome, who was Winston Churchill's mother, born in New York, was not going to win any Parent of the Year awards. She and her husband, Lord Randolph, were neglectful and distant and cold parents to Churchill, Lord Randolph more so than Jenny. And I think the way Churchill reacted to that was to dwell in his imagination even more than most children. He collected thousands of toy soldiers and enacted great battles. He idealized his parents because he didn't have reality to besmirch that image. He once said of his mother, "She shone for me like the evening star, brilliantly but at a distance." And so he was able to learn to reinvent reality, to reimagine reality that upset him. And that would be a very useful tool when he came to meet Franklin Roosevelt. Now, cut from Blenheim Palace and London of the late 19th century to the Hudson Valley and Franklin Roosevelt, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, his mother, was exactly the opposite of the Churchill parents. She smothered Churchill, smothered Roosevelt in the affection and attention that Winston Churchill longed for, so much so that FDR was forced, I think, to create a place where he could keep secrets, a kind of emotional zone of privacy, we would call it today. He invented a code so that he could have a private code in his diary and his letters. The only reason to invent a code is if you think someone's reading it, which he believed his mother was. He managed to court and become engaged to Eleanor Roosevelt without his mother ever finding out. He was a very elusive, and as one of his aides said, deeply forested human beings. And because of that, I think when they intersected years later in the middle of the 20th century, when everything hung in the balance, the fate of democracy, the fate of democratic capitalism, Churchill brought this broad, imaginative, open-hearted, warm, moved-to-tears, Renaissance pageant sense of splendor and destiny, and a sense of really, as he put it, the night he became prime minister, that all his life had been but preparation for this hour and for this trial. Roosevelt was an elusive, more emotionally nimble character who compartmentalized things better. He was not as open as Churchill was. He was a man who could deceive his wife. He had a famous and life-defining affair during the First World War that he carried on to some degree and to some extent until the day he died. His mistress was with him in Warm Springs when he had his final stroke. Roosevelt was a man who wanted to tell people what he wanted them to know on his terms. And I think that's something he learned at Hyde Park. And Churchill was a man who would tell you everything he knew three different times, always eloquently, of course.
Yes.
Churchill's daughter told me, actually, that sitting between the president and the prime minister was like sitting between two lions roaring at the same time. They both loved the sound of their own voices. But Churchill was this buoyant, boyish figure. You know, he wore these, what he called his rompers, his siren suit that he could zip up for air raid warnings, and would bounce around and roll rocks down a hill and loved shooting guns. And I think would have just been more fun to be around, frankly, than President Roosevelt. But I think that's the key difference, was their emotional makeups. Churchill was open, Roosevelt was more closed.
Well, and it's one of the things I love about this book is that we find those kind of differences illuminated again and again, but in all kinds of different ways. I think one of the ones that jumps to mind, for instance, was that Winston Churchill was very anxious that FDR win re-election to a third term in 1940.
Right.
And that when, in fact, FDR does defeat Wendell Willkie, Winston Churchill sends congratulations to President Roosevelt, and Roosevelt never responds. And Churchill sends something again, I think you say, maybe 10 days later. And again, Roosevelt does not bother to respond. And there are those little moments of hurt feelings on Churchill's part and FDR's seeming indifference, which just illuminates the complicated connection between these two gentlemen, at least at that point in time.
Absolutely. No, and it's an I recommend it to everyone. It's an amazing telegram not to respond. Churchill says in his congratulatory telegram of November 1940, I'm thrilled you remember that, it's one of my favorite moments. He says that Churchill says to Roosevelt, things are afoot which shall be remembered and discussed as long as the English language is spoken anywhere in the globe. And you are, you know, entering a commanding role in the destiny of the world. I mean, it's this amazing letter. You know, we'd all kill to get a letter like this. And FDR just didn't mention it, didn't acknowledge it. And then poor Churchill, sort of like a sophomore in high school, was forced to send a note saying, by the way, did you happen to get my note? He once said himself, Churchill understood this, he said, no lover ever studied the whims of his mistress as I did those of Franklin Roosevelt. Churchill's daughter told me that whenever, and this really crystallized the theme of the book for me several years ago when I was interviewing her, she says that whenever she thinks of the president and papa, she always thinks of the French proverb, in love there's one who kisses and one who offers the cheek. And papa was always kissing and the president was always offering the cheek. Now, clinically, if you were a less, if one wanted to make the case, one could say, well, then is this really a friendship? It was a marriage of convenience and obviously an unequal one. I'll grant all that. My argument, which is taking a step back from that, is that all friendships are friendships of convenience, or most friendships are, and almost all of them are unequal in some way. Think about the words we use to describe our friends, neighbors, teammates, classmates, colleagues. All those words connote some kind of shared context or shared goal. And Roosevelt and Churchill were, of course, brought together by the force of circumstance. And, of course, America, as the more powerful nation, was going to be the senior partner in this alliance. But you cannot read these letters. You cannot reconstruct from the memoirs and the transcripts as I did. I waded through each of the 113 days, almost hour by hour. And the record just leads you to one inescapable conclusion, which is that, like any human relationship, that between Roosevelt and Churchill was a mix of affection and artifice. And I know in my own life I have dozens upon dozens of such relationships. And I suspect you do too. And I suspect if we are honest with ourselves, we will remember and realize that friendship is the hardest relationship to define because it's at once the most common and the most complicated. It's not like love where you say that forever I will be yours or you will be mine. It's more situational. It's more by choice. It's more changing. The most changeable, it seems to me, of human exchanges.
It's like a living thing, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly, and it's organic in that it can die. But the intensity, I just ask everybody to think in their own lives. Everyone has at some point had a friend whom they thought they would die for or kill for or sometimes kill, depending on what happened, whom now they have no contact with whatever. And basically, that does not mean that the intensity of the emotion and the affection and the mutual respect that you felt then was any less valid. Of course it was valid. It's what you felt at the time. But down the years, through changed circumstances, some of those relationships survive and some do not. But that does not mean that in that moment, when you shared something, whether it was a neighborhood or a class or a job or whatever it was, that you were not in a genuine friendship. And that was true of Roosevelt and Churchill.
As a friendship is a living thing, then we, of course, see the friendship between Churchill and Roosevelt ebb and flow, after a first sort of uncomfortable encounter during the First World War, which you talk about, and then some of these turbulent months early in the Second World War, when Churchill is so desperate for the help of the American people. Really, the friendship becomes, in some ways, the strongest from 1941 to 1943, once the two have finally met face-to-face and the United States enters the Second World War with full force.
Right.
At that point, this friendship becomes a truly splendid thing.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. From about the 11th of December, 1941, till about the 30th of November, 1943, Roosevelt and Churchill's interests were almost entirely aligned. It was the early days of our participation in the war. They spent Christmas together that first year, as we were talking about. Churchill came to the United States three other times in those years. He was at Hyde Park a good bit. Roosevelt would be driving his – Roosevelt had a special Ford outfitted with levers so he could drive the car, and he loved to lose the Secret Service in the woods and race up to the edge of a cliff with a passenger in. Poor Churchill almost went over the edge of the Hudson. So there was very much a kind of great sense of adventure and togetherness in those years. And then at Tehran in late November, early December of 1943, Stalin enters the scene in a big way. And Roosevelt made a correct political bet that the post-war world was going to be one in which the Soviet Union and the United States were the two large powers. And that left Britain and, by extension, Churchill to the sidelines. And Churchill saw it. He was such a brilliant man. He felt it. He later said that at Tehran, he realized what a small nation we are. Here I was, a little English donkey, sitting between a great American buffalo on one side and the great Soviet bear on the other. And Roosevelt turned in many ways on Churchill on this occasion. He teased him in front of Stalin. He joked about him, all in a rather juvenile attempt, I think, to play up to Stalin. Stalin did not trust Churchill. We forget this now, but Churchill commanded and led a British attack on the Bolshevik Revolution in 1919 and opposed communism fervently through the 20s and 30s. As you may remember, when Hitler turned on Stalin and invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, Churchill immediately forgot all of that. And this connects back to my point about his childhood. He reimagined everything immediately and became a great ally of Stalin's. He did say to an aide that if Hitler invaded hell, he would find a kind word to say about the devil in the House of Commons. But Roosevelt thought that if he appeared to be cooler on Churchill, that that would warm Stalin's heart. I don't think anything could warm Stalin's heart, but Roosevelt was trying and doing what he could. And I asked Mary Soames, I asked Churchill's daughter, whether my reading of the record was right, that Churchill was wounded at Tehran. And she said, yes, I think Papa was very hurt there. But in a remarkable way, Churchill rode back into the breach. He was able to forgive Roosevelt this, I think, betrayal. I certainly portray it that way in the book. Tehran is the hinge in many ways of the friendship as I see it, which follows the way you characterized it so well. And then they entered a kind of twilight. 1944 and 45, light and dark were mixed up. And it wasn't that they drifted apart so much. They were just rather like an old married couple, I think, who knew each other's weaknesses so well but couldn't imagine life without the other. My favorite story about that is from Yalta. In February of 1945, Roosevelt comes back from a long day of meeting with Churchill and Stalin and grumbles to Jimmy Burns, the former Secretary of State who was there, that Winston has developed a tendency to deliver long speeches which he has delivered before. And Secretary Burns said, yes, but they were good speeches. And Roosevelt was forced to chuckle and say, well, Winston doesn't make any other kind. So there was always a mutual respect and really affection there, even unto the end. And Churchill said to Roosevelt in the next presidential election after 1940, said to him privately, I simply can't go on without you. And 44 was a year, one of the things that I found so interesting in doing the book was finding out, which I had just missed in my own reading of previous books, how how much time the two men spent talking about their wives, about their health, about their children. Almost all their children were in uniform. Almost all of them were under fire, even the daughters. Churchill's daughters saw combat.
And you are so right that we tend not to ever think about them in those terms as fathers and husbands. I mean, we know that they were fathers and husbands, but we just can't see past the persona of them as world leaders. That
right.
overpowers everything else.
Sure, you see the photographs and you listen to the speeches, and there they are. But both Clementine Churchill and Eleanor Roosevelt were absolutely essential to their husbands' successes in life. But both Mrs. Churchill and Mrs. Roosevelt were, an evening with them would not be undertaken lightly. they were both, could be quite a handful. Mrs. Churchill was given to fits of temper. She once threw a dish of spinach at Winston. Eleanor Roosevelt, as rather famously, could be quite tedious, lecturing FDR when all I wanted to do was drink that heavy vermouth drinks, which is one of the reasons he sought company with other women who would just listen to the same stories again and again. As a great man, he wanted an audience at some part of the day because he'd been working so hard. He didn't want to hear about how, though he was fighting a two-front global war, things weren't going so well in West Virginia. Mm. That's the last thing he wanted to talk about. And so but then at the same time, a very touching detail I discovered or connected the dots on anyway, was the night before D-Day, June 5th, 1944, when they knew that they could lose 10,000 men the next day, this was the hinge of the war, they both spent the night, the evening beforehand, alone with their wives. FDR and Eleanor dined alone, which virtually never happened during the war. And Churchill and Clementine dined alone, which is one of only five occasions in 1944 when they did.
Hmm.
So in times of great stress, in times of great decision, when life and death was very much in the air, the bond of marriage reasserted itself for both men, which I think is very touching.
Hmm. A last quick question. I think one of the things that is so propitious about you writing this book as you have now is that you had the great privilege, of course, of being able to speak with people who were there.
Yeah.
Who are the most important people? You've mentioned a couple of them, of course, in the course of this interview, that you spoke to and who could really shed unique, helpful light on this story.
There were three who really stand out, maybe four. Lady Soames, who was with the president and the prime minister a good bit, was actually went swimming and had a picnic at Hyde Park with FDR. A man named George Elsie, who was a young reservist in the military and was the map room aide in the White House and was actually the young man sitting there taking notes as Roosevelt and Churchill debated about where to land and how to respond to Stalin. A woman named Truda Lash, who's the great biographer Joe Lash's widow,
yes.
who was very close to Mrs. Roosevelt, who was often in the White House in those years and is now in her 90s, still living down in Greenwich Village. She was hugely helpful. And Robert Hopkins, the son of the FDR's great aide, Harry Hopkins. And he took many of the famous pictures we have of the big three together at Tehran and at Yalta were taken by Robert Hopkins, who as a young man was a Signal Corps photographer. And all of them were able to remember small details. As we often say around here, yesterday's gossip is tomorrow's history. And just what the men were like when they were drinking together, or what they called each other, you know, Franklin and Winston in private. Just tiny little things that cumulatively shed light on, I think, the friendship that really shaped the way we live now.
The book is Franklin and Winston, and the author, Joe Meacham. Mr. Meacham, I thank you for writing this book, and I thank you for joining us today to speak about it on the morning show.
I appreciate your having me. Thank you.
John Meacham will be a special guest of Carthage College on Saturday, May 26, 2 o'clock in the afternoon at Siebert Chapel, an opportunity for you to meet him and hear from him directly. finishing out our morning show today, also out of the archives from 2009, the book Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle in the 100 Days That Created Modern America. This book by Adam Cohen focuses on the first 100 days of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, when, as the country was reeling from the brutal effects of the Great Depression, Roosevelt and his closest advisors moved quite aggressively to reshape America and do what they could to take us out of that very, very frightening time. The book published by Penguin, again, from 2009, Nothing to Fear. Here's that interview with the author, Adam Cohen.
One of the things that I was struck by as I read your book is that I know something about FDR and at least a little bit about those days, but I realize now I didn't know very much. And in particular, I made the mistake that many people do of actually giving a little too much credit to Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself, when in fact it was the circle of advisors around him that really created and crafted what we have come to call the New Deal. Talk for a moment about where credit belongs for what was accomplished in 1933.
Sure. And, you know, first of all, FDR was an amazing leader. I don't want to take anything away from that. He was a great communicator. He had great compassion for people. His inaugural address was, you know, one of the most important ever given, his fireside chats, and his ability to spot talent, all remarkable. That said, he also came into office not sure exactly what he wanted to do about the Great Depression. He believed in balanced budgets. He wanted to cut the federal budget by 25%, which he actually did. He didn't really come up with the New Deal until his advisors brought him really good ideas. So it was people like Francis Perkins, his labor secretary, Henry Wallace, his agriculture secretary, Harry Hopkins, his federal relief administrator, who came to him with public works programs, federal relief programs, and had to persuade him. And they really fleshed out what we now know as the New Deal.
You say, in fact, in the book's introduction, Roosevelt did not have a deep understanding of many of the problems facing the nation. I mean, that's a little bit frightening to think about, but of course, I think you're just trying to be honest in assessing, in the face of what tends to be the attitude of many, which is that FDR came into office already with this magnificent plan in place. In fact, he didn't.
That's right. And when you read the memoirs and oral histories of the people around FDR, when they speak honestly, they say they were surprised. You know, he didn't really know that much economics. He didn't really care that much exactly what the agricultural program would be. He just wanted a good program. In many cases, he didn't follow the details. He had a great spirit, a great political sense, you know, the right goals, but it really was the people around him who had to bring him ideas and often really explain them to him pretty carefully. FDR was a big picture kind of guy that gets lost a little bit in the history.
Right. You quote a journalist from the day, John Franklin Carter, is saying that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not invent the New Deal. He does not own it. He is its master of ceremonies. How would you say this is, in what way is this true? In what way is this a good way to describe at least part of Roosevelt's role in all this?
Well, I think that is true, that master of ceremonies aspect, that he presided over the New Deal. He was the host, but then he would bring along someone like Henry Wallace, the agriculture secretary, and say, go get me an agriculture plan. And Henry Wallace came back with this famous Agricultural Adjustment Act, the first plan to give farm subsidies. Or he'd say to Frances Perkins, find me a relief program. And she would come back with one, and he accepted it. So a lot of it was really, you know, presiding, but bringing the right people in and letting them do, in large part, what they thought was right. So that made him, you know, more master of ceremonies than, you know, than person, you know, coming up with the plans himself.
Let's talk for a moment about his predecessor, Herbert Hoover. I think one of the things I was sort of pleasantly surprised about in your book, or this is something I didn't necessarily expect to find in the pages of your book, is I think a really thoughtful assessment of why President Hoover acted, or in some respects failed to act, as he did in response to this horrific crisis. and that it was not just aloofness or disinterest, but because of a personal philosophy of Mr. Hoover's that, in a sense, kept him from doing anything more aggressive to combat the situation. Can you just talk a moment about that?
Sure. In many ways, Hoover gets a bad rap as being indifferent and cold and uncaring about, you know, the millions who are unemployed. In fact, he was a humanitarian, and he made his name bringing food relief to Europe. So he cared about people, but he also believed strongly in capitalism, and he believed in rugged individualism. He wrote a whole book about it. So he really believed that letting the system work itself out, by and large, letting people solve their own problems, would be the best approach. He meant well, but it really wasn't the right approach. And the American people realized that when they elected FDR. FDR saw it when he took office. Hoover was part of an old philosophy that was, you know, sincerely felt, but it just wasn't correct.
I think a lot of us know the story of how bitter Hoover was about the defeat and of how there was such tremendous tension on Inauguration Day 1933, and Hoover scarcely spoke a word to FDR that day. But your book tells us about some very interesting contacts that were made by Hoover to his successor, some attempts to form something of a partnership in an interesting way, a little bit like some of the cooperation which ultimately has occurred between the current president and the president-elect. Tell us about some of that activity between Hoover and Roosevelt, which ultimately came to naught.
Sure. Hoover did reach out to President-elect Roosevelt. He invited him down to Washington a couple of times to meet at the White House. He sent him a letter inviting them to work together on the banking crisis, which was the big crisis of the day. And FDR really spurned these entreaties. Now, you get two sides of this. There are people who say that that FDR just didn't want to taint himself with any association with a very unpopular president. He wanted to come into office on his own and make his own mark, and that maybe he should have worked more with him. Other people will point out to the fact that Hoover really did want the cooperation to be on his terms, and Hoover actually wrote a letter to a member of Congress in which he said, you know, if I get FDR to go along with me the way I want, he'll have to abandon 95% of the, you know, so-called New Deal. So it's not clear how good the cooperation would have been from FDR's perspective, but in any case, FDR didn't want it. He wanted to start fresh when he took office.
Hmm. And, of course, that is what he ultimately did. He is an immensely popular president. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is from the great Will Rogers, who says about Roosevelt, trying to describe the scope of his charisma and confidence and popularity. Will Rogers said, if he, meaning Roosevelt, burned down the Capitol, we would cheer and say, well, at least we got a fire started anyhow. I mean, people were so desperate for something to happen, even if it was something sort of scary and bewildering. I mean, any kind of action was welcomed by a huge swath of the American public.
That's right. And someone who actually lived through that period emailed me yesterday and used what I thought was a great phrase. She said, remember, Roosevelt was our religion. And I think people really felt that way back then. Hmm. That's how much they believed.
Hmm. And, of course, it probably would have been disconcerting for a lot of those people to realize that, in fact, FDR's overarching philosophy coming into office was basically two words, try something. But what that something ultimately was going to be, he really didn't know at that point in time.
Right, but he was very good about not letting people know that. He always projected supreme confidence. And I think also people really knew that he was on their side. He was going to find something that would work. And I think that's why people believed in him. I don't think that they thought he was necessarily the smartest policy guy in the world, but they knew that he cared about them and was fighting for them. And I think that part was true. They were right to have faith in him on that.
Right. One of the things which is important to Roosevelt is for him to surround himself with very good people. In fact, you say he was interested in establishing a new form of government, a factocracy. What is meant by that? Actually, I think you're quoting somebody else in talking about the formation of the Brain Trust, but what is this idea of the factocracy?
Yeah, well, FDR really believed in expertise, and that goes back to during the campaign in 1932, he created this group called the Brain Trust, which was professors from largely from Columbia University, a few other places, who were going to come up with, you know, very elaborate, very well thought out policy proposals. FDR didn't always know everything himself, but he believed in going to experts, and that carried through to government. He brought in a lot of the Brain Trust people into the government with him, and he wanted experts to go into their areas and tell him what to do. That was, I think, you know, the beginning of a new approach to government, expertise and knowledge, and it was a very good thing, I think, about FDR's approach to government.
Something else that's fascinating about it, and we see it in his entire cabinet and also in this very close circle of five advisors who are especially instrumental in the formation of the New Deal, is the wide range which they represent. You say Roosevelt chose cabinet members and top aides with a range of beliefs reflecting his own conflicted views. Tell us a moment about that, about Roosevelt's conflicted views and how those that he surrounded himself with were, in fact, a reflection of that.
Sure. FDR was, you know, surprisingly a fiscal conservative. He believed in a balanced budget. He believed in cutting federal spending. So to represent that part of his psyche, he got a budget director, Lewis Douglas, one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, who had fought government spending, who came from a very conservative family in Arizona of copper barons. So that was one part of FDR. But FDR also really cared about working people and the unemployed, wanted to help the victims of the Depression, and he brought in people like Francis Perkins, who was a champion of working people, who had been a social worker, who had been working for minimum wage and maximum hour laws. Also brought in Harry Hopkins, a social worker, a guy from Iowa who moved to the Lower East Side of New York to work with immigrants, and Harry Hopkins was there fighting for federal relief, you know, as they called welfare back then, and for public works. So he had people around him who were representing all of his different views, fighting among themselves, and pulling him in different directions. And that's how FDR managed to get to where he really wanted to go in the end.
One of the most fascinating points you make about the banking crisis, which was really the first thing at the top of the agenda, the thing that needed the most immediate, urgent sort of attention, the banking crisis, was something that ultimately was dealt with in a quite uncommon sort of cooperation between the Roosevelt administration and a handful of administrators from Hoover's administration. And actually the night before is kind of a late night session between some of Roosevelt's men and some of Hoover's men working very hard to come up with something that was going to be the first step in combating the crisis. Talk a moment about this cooperation, which never did occur between Roosevelt and Hoover themselves, but did occur on sort of the next level down.
Yes, exactly right. And it's kind of shocking that with the banks all failing and this banking crisis after the election, that FDR came into office without a banking plan. He had no particular program or strategy for saving the banking system. So what ended up happening is Raymond Moley, among others, said to him, you know, the real banking experts right now happen to be the people who work for Hoover in the Treasury Department. They've been out there working on this stuff. So FDR said to Raymond Moley and his Treasury Secretary, William Wooden, go work with them. So that's what they did. And what they did is they got Hoover's team to come up with a banking proposal, and that was the banking proposal that FDR ended up adopting. And that shows really FDR's strong strain of pragmatism. He didn't feel it had to be his plan or even a Democratic plan. He was looking for the best plan in every area, and in this case, the best plan for saving the banking system, which FDR did in the first 8 days in office, happened to be the Hoover Group, a group of Hoover officials who had been unable to convince President Hoover to adopt it. They were able to get, you know, these good reforms passed through FDR.
Hmm. Of course, what ends up happening at the start of it is what one expert called the anesthetic before the major operation, and that was simply the calling of that extraordinary bank holiday across the country. You tell us that the really pivotal moment was when a number of those banks were going to finally be allowed to reopen Monday morning. And so ahead of that, FDR gives the first of what, of course, was a series of important fireside chats to the nation. But I don't think I've ever read in a book before quite such a riveting account of just how incredibly important this first speech was from Roosevelt. I mean, that is over the radio, the first fireside chat. Tell us why it was so crucial.
Sure, it was incredibly important because the banking system had failed. People were worried that their life savings would be lost because there was no deposit insurance. So FDR closes the banks, and then the big question is, when they're reopened after this bank holiday, what are people going to do? What everyone assumed is that everyone would run down, take out all the money they could, and bury it under their mattresses. FDR knows that if that happens, the banking system will never rebound. So they do take precautions. They have extra money printed up, ready to bring to the banks if they need it. But FDR gives this amazing fireside chat in which he tells people that he's got a plan for the banking system. It's all going to be fine. If their bank is reopened, it means the government has checked and made sure that their money will be safe. And he tells them, your money will be safer in the bank than it would be under a mattress. Then there's the moment of truth when the banks reopen Monday morning, and lo and behold, more people show up to deposit money than to take it out. That was a huge thing, and it really showed FDR's incredible communication skills, that he was able to persuade people after all these bank failures, you know, you're better off bringing your money in than taking it out.
Hmm. You proceed, of course, from there to describe how the rest of the so-called New Deal unfolds, including what surprises us so much, that a significant budget reduction was one of FDR's first measures. And, of course, what is built from there in terms of dealing with the agricultural crisis and helping workers. Please say a word, if you would, about this fascinating figure of Frances Perkins, the first woman to hold a cabinet office. Her story is extraordinary, and especially the way in which she steps into one of the biggest messes in all of Washington and does something about it.
Her entire story is, as you say, extraordinary. Born into a conservative family in Massachusetts, her dad doesn't want her to work when she graduates from college. She moves to Chicago, works with Jane Addams and Hull House, moves to Philadelphia and takes a job, some of which is rescuing women who arrive at the ports and making sure they don't get lured into prostitution. Moves to New York, becomes this amazing social worker, watches the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, 136 women jumping to their death before her eyes. Frances Perkins becomes this major advocate for workers and for factory safety and for the unemployed, works for FDR when he's governor, comes to Washington with him, and when she shows up, the Labor Department is a mess, filled with corrupt people. The thing she does in the first week in office is get rid of all the corruption, the people who are shaking down immigrants and doing other, you know, nasty stuff, cleans them out, and then she gets to work on the problems of working people. She begins pushing for a relief program for the unemployed, gets FDR to adopt it, and then she makes her mission during the 100 days public works, getting a big public works program. And Perkins was largely responsible for persuading FDR to spend $3.3 billion, a huge amount of money in those days, on public works programs to put people to work. Many people are now coming around to the view that Frances Perkins was actually the conscience of the New Deal. And I think she's now getting a recognition that history has long denied her.
Hmm. We learn about her and about other pivotal figures in this pivotal moment in our nation's history in this extraordinary, fascinating book called Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, published by Penguin. Adam Cohen, the author. Adam Cohen, I thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with you about your fascinating book. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a very exciting change of pace. We're going to be stepping into a new business here in Kenosha, Classic Violins. They've been in business for a long, long time down in Mundelein, Illinois. Earlier this year, they opened up a second office in Kenosha. They sell and service and rent string instruments, violins, violas, and cellos. And I'll be speaking with Stephanie Shumanova, whose father is the owner of the business, and Spencer Hammann, who is one of the luthiers who actually works on violins, violas, and cellos, repairing and restoring them. Thursday, Patrick O'Donnell and his book, The Unknowns, The Untold Story of America's Unknown Soldier and World War I's Most Decorated Heroes, Who Brought Him Home. And on Friday,